This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
DC for you. DC for you. DC for you. DC for you.
Todd, what's your favorite man and why is it Animal Man?
Well, first off, my favorite man is Henry Rollins, but my favorite man named Buddy Baker is Animal Man. How about that? Is that relevant? Because Animal Man, I can remember the first time I read anything about Animal Man or saw anything about him was in the classic 1985 era DC comic called Who's Who in the DC Universe. He was one of the very first pages, and I read about Animal Man and how he was can do whatever an animal can. You know, if he has an animal he's in proximity to, he can adapt that animal's abilities to himself and then maybe store that when he needs to. And then they brought him back as part of this group of forgotten heroes in DC Comics Presents, I believe, along with Dolphin and some other classic heroes from DC that nobody really remembered at the time. But
definitely,
we're talking about maybe the latest version of Animal Man, yeah?
Yeah. We're on this episode of DC for You. We're continuing our horror month. And for a character who's traditionally been kind of a bit goofy, like Animal Man, you might not suspect that he would lend himself to a horror title, but you would be wrong, because Jeff Lemire and Travel Foreman launched an ongoing Animal Man title in 2011 as part of the New 52 that was very much a horror book. And today on this episode, we're going to talk about the very first issue of that series. So I know what kind of impression it left on me, which was a big, big surprise, because I wasn't sure what to make of an Animal Man book launching, but the cover was intriguing, so I tried out issue one, and I was hooked through the duration of this series. So, Todd, what was your first impression of Animal Man number one?
Well, I have a confession. I did buy it initially because I bought every number one issue of the New 52. My God, what was I thinking? But
yeah.
That was quite the month. However, I'm still married. And now I do recall reading through it, and I knew it would be saved to be, okay, I'll read this later because Jeff Lemire is great. I love the Green Arrow, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't really remember. So going back and rereading this time around, I love the crap out of this. I can't wait to read more. But at the time, it was one of those things like, okay, this and Scott Snyder's Swamp Thing, I'm going to put them over into this corner, and I know they're going to be something I'll check out later because they seem to be well done. And but I think at the time I was reading so many bloody comics that this one, bloody comics, that's a pun. so this one was shunted off to the side, but I remember it being good. I also read the Grant Morrison Animal Man, and that's kind of a sacred cow for a lot of people, the pre-Vertigo era Animal Man that later became Vertigo. But this kind of takes that character and integrates him more into the traditional DC universe, and it's a very accessible story from the get-go.
It very much is. I love the opening of this issue being a magazine, like an entertainment magazine interview that Buddy Baker, the Animal Man, did to promote this indie movie that he is starring in. Because up to this point, the history that they're giving you of Animal Man is that he's been working as a stuntman in Hollywood, using his abilities to take on the traits of whatever animals are nearby. and used that to pull off some pretty crazy stunt work. And it's been fine as a living. He's not like living a lavish lifestyle by any means with his wife and two kids. But this new venture was like the first time he'd ever starred in an actual movie. Like, he had real lines. He was a featured player. And as is the case with a lot of these indie films, he only gets paid if the movie makes money. So it creates a little tension between he and the missus over that decision to basically have worked for potentially free. And of course, he's got the two kids there. He's very much a family man. His son is very much kind of the, obnoxious older brother to the incredibly cute but also very demanding little sister. Now, what did you think of how Lemire handled the voices of each of these characters? What kind of impression did it make on you?
I like to read these panel by panel, and I got it from the get-go. The voice of the family, the primary four characters, very well defined. Characterizations are there from the get-go. I want to hate Ellen, but then you have to look at the big picture and, you know, how she's holding the family together. Buddy's kind of a flake if you really look at it objectively. So
that's true.
You know, some people may just like be anti her as a shrew from the get-go, but she's really the glue of the family. And how many family oriented or at least books about a true nuclear family do you get in DC or Marvel or otherwise? You get wife and husband and two kids, no pets, but we'll talk about that.
there's a pretty good reason for that. His little girl desperately wants a puppy. But Buddy is like, no, because if I'm around, and this is a good way of introducing some of the weaknesses that he has,
right?
When he's explaining it to his little girl, that if he's around one animal in close proximity for too long, it weakens his abilities to call upon other animals, and he can only be like that one if he's around it for like a certain period of time. So if they had a puppy, all he would ever be is a dog. And some of his, as we see in the issue, he actually does go do the superhero thing. He takes on the traits of a bird so he can fly to a hostage situation at a children's hospital, which is a pretty sad scene. Like, it's tense, but it's also incredibly sad when you think about what's happening when a man has lost his daughter but thinks she's still alive and being held captive by the hospital itself. Pretty tense scene there, I thought, and it was a bit of a shift from the usual, like, okay, we're doing the family man kind of thing at the beginning, introducing him as a character and as a concept. And then we give him this kind of superhero moment where he gets to have what I called his Superman bit, where he does what he can. Like, he uses his powers only so much as it's necessary, but then he really just wants to talk the guy down. He really wants to try and reason with him first and keep anybody, including the gunman, from being hurt. So Buddy Baker, while he is, I think you correctly pointed out there, he is a flake, absolutely. He is not as good at this whole like domestic lifestyle as maybe he should be. But when he suits up as the superhero, he's pretty good at it, at least by my estimation.
Yeah, and it's a nice way in a number one issue to show the reader how the powers work, show what, how he's different from other heroes in that he is first and foremost a father, and he uses that to at least communicate a little bit with the guy. Then you see how his powers work, and he peacefully enough defuses the situation. So, you know, he doesn't incapacitate the guy too badly and lets him, you know, relates to him as a dad and leaves the path open for this guy to get help, because this guy's really traumatized by the loss of his daughter and he's lost his grip on reality. But something happens to him, one of the first peeks into a bigger story. I mean, that would be good enough to, okay, next issue. Let's see what he deals with next issue. But something happens to him at the end of that encounter that leads into the bigger tapestry of the series as a whole.
Yeah, it's it kind of comes out of nowhere, too, because you're like, okay, well, you're starting to relax a bit because he's diffused the situation. It's over. But then one of the cops who's on the scene is like, why is there blood flowing from your eyes? And it's dripping down his face. He's not in pain. There's no obvious injuries. The doctors check him out while he's there. But it's like, wow, that is really out of nowhere. And it's this horrific looking scene, beautifully illustrated by Travel Foreman. But after he gets checked out and seems to be fine, almost kind of against doctor's orders, he just decides to go home. He's like, I just want to go home. I just want to, like, you know, rest and maybe, like, get my head straight here, because this was a really freaky thing that just happened. And then when he gets home, something even more, like, horrifying happens, because he has this, like, pretty, like, gnarly nightmare sequence, which completely changes the tone of the book.
Yes.
For the last third. What did you think about Travel Foreman illustrating that nightmare scape of Buddy Baker's mind?
Yeah, so many trees and veins. You know, this is one of the themes in this, veins and branches of veins, because blood is such a big part of this series. And we must note that the dream sequence is in black and white, which lets the red blood found in and gut found in the dream sequence stand out that much more, which is interesting. Yeah, it kind of puts the book on its side, showing horrible things happening with his children.
Yeah, that's...
And, you know, his biggest fear, but it's also definitely tying into something else here.
Very much so. This is, as you alluded to earlier in the episode, Animal Man, this Animal Man series tied very closely with another New 52
Swamp
series,
Thing, yeah.
Swamp Thing, from Scott Snyder and Yannick Paquette, which was also beautifully illustrated, but also gets into, like, some pretty deep, like, body horror elements. And this one certainly does. The river of blood that seems to be running through what Buddy Baker believes is a dream, but is actually his tie to an elemental force called the Red, which ties all animal life on the planet together. The life web that he reaches into to pull his pull animal traits from is like the tie to the Red itself, and he's tied to it in a similar way to how Swamp Thing is tied to the Green, which is the connective life web of all plant life on the planet. The gray that he's seeing is, I believe, the foreshadowing of the coming of the rot, or the gray, which is death and decomposition, where all things are tied together. Gets into some pretty complex stuff as the series goes along, but what this really does is, like, get into the most horrific aspects of how all life is tied together. And as you said, Buddy is seeing these awful things happen to his son, who, like, literally has his guts spilled out. That was kind of a shocking scene to me, that even though it's a dream sequence, here's this, like, I guess he's a preteen kid, literally has his guts just, like, fall out on the ground. And he's telling his dad as he's dying that it's his sister that did it. And when he sees his, like, when Buddy sees his little girl come upon him, she leads him to this, like, river of blood to try and hide from some, like, evil force that seems to be coming for them. All of this, of course, eventually, like, ends. Buddy wakes up and is thinking, wow, that was a Mondo nightmare. But then the screaming starts in real life. And then we see what has happened with his little girl, who is definitely her father's daughter, I guess, is a way of putting it. What did you think of that last scene, the last page?
At first, I thought she had just found a whole bunch of dead animals, but she apparently has reanimated them and brought them to her. Is that what's going on?
Yes.
I don't know if we know that. Okay. Because they're in lifelike poses. You know, they're doing things that alive animals would be doing. But you've got a decapitated cat.
decomposing lots of animals. That's his daughter's ability. She reanimates dead animals. And it is, it's gross. It's got a bit of a Pet Cemetery vibe going on because you don't know if his daughter is very clearly tied to the Red. But as we find out, as both this series and Swamp Thing goes along, the Red and the Green and even the Rot are not inherently good or evil. They can be both. And Buddy starts to worry that, you know, of course, his daughter developed abilities that are beyond his own, where she's, you know, pulling back from the dead. So is she also tied to the Rot in a way? And is she actually going to be good, or does this make her evil? That's what his nightmare seemed to be about, was could his daughter, his young child daughter, be about to, you know, go for a big heel turn? That's some pretty horrific stuff that's going on here in the book. So it made a big impression on me, and I absolutely had to go get issue two and keep this going. But I was sold on Swamp Thing from the creative team alone. I didn't know much about Jeff Lemire at the time, but after this, I was like, this dude has got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this may have been, I think Green Arrow again was the first time he got on my radar, and I sure like Black Hammer, and he's done great stuff with Old Man Logan and other books too, but this there's no reason for me to think that this wouldn't be something I'd love. You can tell he definitely got a lot of inspiration from the Alan Moore run of Swamp Thing with those concepts of the Green and the Red. The Red is kind of, well, why wouldn't that make sense? Let's use that established framework that we have of the Green and Swamp Thing's connection to them. Why wouldn't that have a life or an animal life equivalent? And who better than Animal Man to be the embodiment of that, or at least the connection to that? So you see a little bit of it in the art too. Remember when in the classic Saga of the Swamp Thing, I believe it's 21, the anatomy lesson, Swamp Thing creates his own body. I got that kind of a vibe from when we just see Buddy's brain and nervous system made up of veins and blood. So that kind of made me think of the art by Stephen Bissette from that classic issue of Swamp Thing, which is, again, holy and blameless, and everybody should read it and understand it and know it, because it's 30-year-old comics, 35-year-old comics that hold up to this day and are still, you know, we're still feeling the influences of them. In fact, the excellent Swamp Thing series that came out on DC Universe owes a lot of roots to it as well. Oh, I said roots. So,
well, yeah. We're going to get deep on Swamp Thing probably in our next episode, because we're going to review the first episode of that Swamp Thing series. And before we get to that, though, you've read more Animal Man than I have, I'm sure. Did you read the Grant Morrison Animal Man series?
I read the first two trades, and they were very interesting. Definitely fleshed out the character quite a bit, and eventually became very meta. You know, Grant was doing something very, very different with the story. I say Grant like I know him. Morrison was doing something very, very different with the story, with the family dynamic, and eventually strayed more into horror issues. But to me, it became very psychological and like, okay, I recognize that this is decent. This is very, very good comics, but I don't think it's necessarily for me. However, the Brian Bolland covers are the best thing about the whole thing. The Brian Bolland covers from those issues are just works of art, if you ever get to track down those.
Yeah, no, those are also on DC Universe. Those are okay. I have certainly seen those covers, and they are, like you said, they're absolutely tremendous. They're pretty iconic stuff. But certainly, as I understood it, the Grant Morrison Animal Man is very different from the Jeff Lemire Animal Man. They are not really related so much as, like, you get some of the history from Grant Morrison's run. Like, some of that is acknowledged by Jeff Lemire, but this story very much goes in its own direction and goes deep on those, like, those horror roots. Like, it establishes that from this first issue and steers heavy into it. So what do you think about Animal Man that makes him such a good character to put in a horror story? What is it that you think just about him as a character made this story work so well?
I'm going to say because he's a dad and a relatable character, and he has actual stakes, you know, he has something to lose. So that draws you in a little bit more as far as consequences to a story like that. It's not just some dumb teenager who did dumb things and deserves to die and be slashed. This is a guy that we care about and empathize with, that also with the connections to animal savagery, you can go places with nature being cruel and gross at times.
Very much so. I mean, it lends itself to the idea of things that can get real bloody real fast. And there are so many aspects to, like you said, like in nature, just in the world of animals themselves, that, you know, can be a bit on the disgusting and horrific side, like the savagery of it. That's a good way to put it. The absolute savagery of some of the story elements that come along as this story progresses are really unsettling. And Lemire, as a horror writer, is really kind of at the top of his game in this. But I think that if it weren't for the, like, almost human anatomy lesson vibe or style of Travel Foreman's art, that the story might not have worked as well as it did. My God, that artwork just sticks with you, doesn't it?
Certainly does. The using the vein and vessels iconography is very powerful, and
making it look like a tree.
Yeah,
they make it look like roots.
Tying it in. So interesting.
I loved that aspect of it, that it looked like, I didn't pick up on it until later, that because this was tying so closely to Swamp Thing, that whenever you see all the stuff that looks like veins from the red, it also looks like tree roots. So it's, man, what a great, like, 1-2 punch those two books absolutely were. And then, of course, they led to the big crossover event between the two that closed out Scott Snyder's time on Swamp Thing.
How long did this book run? Not for the full 52, right?
I don't think so. I'm struggling to remember exactly how many issues it ran, but there was the Rot World.
29 looks to be the farthest I can see on DCU.
Gotcha. So. That should be the whole series, because it continues on a bit after Rot World concludes, but and Swamp Thing does too. Like, Swamp Thing keeps going after that when Charles Soule takes over writing the book from Scott Snyder. But the connection between Animal Man and Swamp Thing kind of ends once Scott Snyder leaves the book.
Okay.
So it's only going to go up to that point. But I did read, I collected the entire Animal Man series and loved it from beginning to end. Even without the crossover connection with Swamp Thing, it continued being a really good story that very much blazed its own trail outside of those two, outside of that intersection. It was like, okay, well, we tied these two books together to begin with, but they were always meant to eventually go their own way. So Animal Man very much does that.
Was he a character that was in Brightest Day at all?
I believe so.
I think they did. So that was before New 52.
Swamp Thing numerically was.
Okay. The series ran for 29, but they also had two annuals, also written by Lemire, and a zero issue. Remember when zero issues were a thing?
Yes.
Often they would be origin stories for the characters, but coming out a year after the series had started. So.
Yeah, DC tried that whole, we'll do one issue origin stories for certain characters to help give people a little more depth and background on the New 52 takes. And some of that worked, some of it didn't. Animal Man, I think, was one that worked pretty well. So you're, everybody would do well to go and check out this this entire series, I think. And then, of course, I read the crossover stuff with Swamp Thing. And I would also recommend another book that Jeff Lemire did for a little while in the New 52 called Frankenstein, Agent of Shade. That one also has like one or two issues that tied into Rotworld, but that book actually stood very strongly on its own and is one of those unsung gems of the New 52 that I think a lot of people just like unfairly slept on because it was a weird, like non-mainstream character. But it's actually a real good book while Jeff Lemire's writing it.
If you go with somebody who's written, who has some notoriety as a good writer, you're probably going to like that book, even if you aren't familiar with the stuff around it, you know, the characters he's writing. The guys like Jeff Lemire, Mark Russell, there are a lot of those. And I'm a writer's guy. I buy books based on the writer if I'm not tied to continuing a collection, like Batman. How, you know, I've got a very long linear group of Batman comics, but generally I follow writers. So Lemire is somebody that I'm going to try and check out almost everything he's done. And eventually I'll finish getting current with you guys on Gideon Falls too, in Image.
Can't recommend that series enough. Good mention, like a little shouts to Image in our horror month. Gideon Falls is a good one to jump on for that. But this is like all you DC fans out there and all you potential DC fans, if you want something good and scary, like a good horror series to follow through the month of October, read you an issue of Animal Man a day. I don't think you're ever going to be disappointed. With that, anything else to, who would you recommend this book to, Todd? What kind of fans, out there would you say would like this book?
Fathers.
Yeah.
It's a good one for fathers. How about that? And people looking for something besides just the standard capes and punches superhero story. So this is less about his heroic abilities and more about his connection to a bigger world and the so much he would have to lose as a father. The stakes are raised.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And I would also say if you're a fan of, I want to say John Carpenter's The Thing, honestly. Like if you're into that style of horror, if that movie is something that you enjoyed, I think you should check out Animal Man. I think there are some things in there that might pique your interest. So with that, that's going to bring this episode of DC for you to an end. And what we're going to do next week, as I said earlier, we're going to come back and take a look at the first episode of DC Universe's Swamp Thing television series, which has unfortunately been canceled after 10 episodes. But we're going to take a look at it and give our opinion on whether or not that was fair and if this is a series that we can put our stamp of recommendation on. So come back next week. And we will see you next time.
DC for you.
For you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 2 dozen podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Thanks for listening to DC for You. We've got lots of shows to check out on PlaceToBeNation.com, including our weekly shows from Pop. Hard Traveling Fanboys go off the page and kick off their annual Walking Dead month with the discussion of Fear the Walking Dead Episode 4, Season 1, including Morgan's crossing over to Fear the Walking Dead. Brother Sister Rewatch looks at The Office Season 3, Episodes 9 and 10, including A Benihana Christmas, Michael Scott hijinks. As we're in October, Scott Criscolo continues his look at the Universal Monsters in the latest edition of Pop Goes the Classics with 1931's Frankenstein. Fire bad! DC4U, last week we talked about DC Comics' best horror offerings. We had a list of mine and Russell's favorite scary DC stories. Plus, we had a look at Keanu Reeves' Constantine film from 2005. This Week in the NFL hits every week. Roger and Johnny recapping the latest set of games. The 49ers are still undefeated. And we preview the upcoming weekend's batch. Skipping to Laugh in Theater because I messed up the live read listening. Andy welcomes David Sunday to Live Watch, So I Married an Axe Murderer. Harriet, I think I did that joke last time, on the latest episode of PTBN's E-Ticket Attraction, it is Halloween Horror Nights time. Jason Sherman, Andy Atherton discuss Universal Studios Orlando, and Starla Marie Locke came on the show to talk about those horror mazes. Pop Goes the Movies looks at the controversial Joker film. Join J. Arsenio D'Amato and Andy as they look at DC's latest. On the website, actually on our Facebook group, Greatest Song of the 80s Tournament included Sweet Child of Mine 1. Not Michael Jackson, but Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. Next tournament will be announced on October 14th on the Mothership Place to Be Nation. No, sorry, Place to Be Podcast. Jennifer Smith has her own podcast feed now called The Jenny Position. Find it on Podbean and iTunes and subscribe. We have a Halloween movie challenge. We've got lots of great films to recommend for you. Use the hashtag PTBN Halloween Movie Challenge. Check us out on Facebook over at Place to Be Nation Wrestling. We had Hell in a Cell recap from Chris and Devin. I was at Hell in a Cell, and I had got to say, it was an unsatisfactory finish. Over at the Place to Be Nation podcast, no, Place to Be podcast, the Mothership, JT and Scott begin a new decade as Steve Bennett, the esteemed Steve Bennett, joins them for January 15th Madison Square Garden House Show. We had a new issue, new episode of Please Be Nation Extreme Three-Way Dance. JT, Johnny, and Jenny continue their ECW adventure with When Worlds Collide. Main event, Scott, Nate, and Steve previewed the Wednesday night war between AEW and NXT, plus Steve Lilly's New Japan Classic match pick. Benzani interviews Ian Riccoboni plus Marco and Logan Stunt on episode 23 of Row 1, Seat 1. And then episode 24 had All Ego Ethan Page. PlaceToBeNation.com has new content every single day, including Glenn's Weekly Walk, Polly's Column, all kinds of great stuff. We have campus hot takes, lots of great stuff. If you're shopping at Amazon, we've got a banner on PlaceToBeNation.com. PlaceToBeNation.com. I'd love for you to click on that banner and then buy something very expensive on Amazon and help PTBN out. Check out our social media pages, Twitter, Facebook for PlaceToBeNation. Bigelow34.proboards.com for information and joining our end of the year project, GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever. So, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.